May is Maytag Month, and Menards is passing the savings on to you. You need reliable and energy-efficient appliances to conquer the day. Menards is your one-stop shop with appliances in stock and ready to take home today. Check out our top appliance brands, including KitchenAid, Maytag, Whirlpool, Amana, and Criterion. Save big money on Maytag appliances at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
It's time to wake to sleep with the number one sleep authority, Sleep Science Today, and Sleep Better Tonight.
What if the very things you're doing to try to fix your insomnia are the exact things that are keeping you awake? Well, we're going to be talking about cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or CBTI. It's the gold standard science-backed approach that doesn't knock you out, but it retrains your brain to sleep again. If you're tired of being tired, this might change everything. This is Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky, and today we're talking with Dr. Elise Murray. She is a licensed psychologist, and one of the things she does is CBTI. So, Dr. Murray, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Andrew. Happy to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. We're going to talk about CBTI in the show and insomnia, but we have a couple other things that we're going to get into as we get going, because so many patients with insomnia also have potential co-occurring disorders, and those are important to know about because they impact the whole big picture and sleep. So let's start off with this. How does someone who's studying psychology decide to get into insomnia and deal with CBTI? What was your story?
Well, actually, when I was in grad school, I was an honor student as an undergrad and got into grad school, and I was shocked at how much more work grad school was, trying to manage, my coursework, beginning to see clients, my research, my job, which incidentally was in a sleep lab, trying to balance all of that. And it was so much that I just found myself really cutting back on my sleep and sleeping in fits and starts and, that sort of thing. And my sleep was absolutely horrible. It just ended up where I just had atrocious insomnia and drinking coffee all day long. And I just felt like, oh my gosh, I'm not going to be able to get through this. And eventually I became a participant in a sleep study of CBTI. And I was absolutely fascinated. I was just lapping it up, and really I saw firsthand, this is so powerful, so effective, and yet it's pretty straightforward. It just made a whole lot of sense. Mm-hmm. So once I became a psychologist, I brought it into the therapy room and used it with folks, and they were surprised too. They were like, wow, this really is effective. So yeah.
That's great. So in your personal experience then, when you were participating in this as a patient, how long did this whole process take from beginning to when you felt that you had made the progress you wanted to make?
Well, the duration of the study was 8 weeks, as I recall. But I mean, I could see benefits before the end of the 8 weeks, certainly. I mean, it was like a gradual process of getting better and better. So that was great.
Okay. Yeah. And that's typically, when you read about CBTI on the internet or just in general, about 8 weeks is a very typical amount of time that people would spend. And, they're going to get the progress that they're looking for, or they're not. Most of the time they do. But here we are talking about CBTI, and we really haven't taken a chance to define it yet or tell people when it might be something they want to look for. So let me start off with this question, because it's a question that I get a lot. People who are told by their doctor or someone that they should look into CBTI, oftentimes, if I'm talking with them, they'll say to me, well, you know, I work with a therapist and we do CBT, so I guess we're doing that. Is CBT the same as CBTI?
No, I mean, there's definitely overlap, but CBT stands for cognitive behavior therapy. And so it's looking at the role of our cognitions, our thoughts, and how they're contributing to whatever difficulties we're having, as well as our behaviors. What are the things that we are, the actions that we're doing that are contributing? And cognitive behavior therapy is a great form of therapy. CBTI, where it's specifically tailored for insomnia, looks at the cognitive piece, specifically looking at what are the beliefs that can be contributing to your sleep difficulties. The behavioral piece is looking at things like sleep hygiene and sleep restriction therapy, which we can talk about in a moment, really looking at what are the behaviors that we need to work with to be able to help with your sleep problem. And so it's a quite structured approach. And so it goes beyond, in certain respects, standard CBT.
Mm-hmm. So if someone is trying to find help with CBTI, then they're going to have to look further than someone who just does CBT.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And okay. So we answered that question. So now let's talk about CBTI itself. So then, what is CBTI? What would someone expect to experience if they came to you and you were going to be offering them CBTI?
Yeah. Well, before we actually get started with CBTI, of course, it's important to have a thorough assessment. So we'd want to know what are the things that are contributing to the sleep difficulty? What's the nature of the sleep difficulty? Because as you know, I mean, for some of us, we have a lot of difficulty falling asleep at the beginning of the night. For some of us, we're waking up too early. For some of us, we're waking up repeatedly. It could be a combination of these things. And most people with sleep difficulties don't just have primary insomnia. They don't just have a sleep problem. They have other things that are contributing to the problem, like depression, anxiety, ADHD, chronic pain, what have you. So a thorough assessment. And then once we've got an idea, a better idea of your sleep difficulty and what might be useful, then we get into education about your sleep, and we collect baseline data. We want to look at very specifically, okay, what exactly is going on? And, you can do this with a tracker like a Fitbit or whatever, but we also usually like to have you jot down some notes about what's going on. And then based on that baseline data, then we can come up with your specific protocol, which is looking at things like, I don't know if we want to get into sleep restriction yet. I'll just mention quickly, we get into the sleep restriction piece, we get into your beliefs, and how might extreme thoughts like, I have to get a good night's sleep or else I'm going to be absolutely, you know, failing everything at work the next day, people tend to kind of make things worse by having these extreme beliefs about their sleep when actually we're more resilient than we give ourselves credit for. And toward the end, of course, looking at how do we maintain these gains? What are the warning signs that you might be getting back into unhealthy sleep patterns and how can you nip that in the bud? Because once you've learned the skills, then if you start to have problems again, usually, I mean, it's like riding a bike. It's just sort of a refresher. Ah, I see what's going on. You know, catch it quickly, get back to the skills, and then, you know, you get back to sleeping well, typically, you know, more quickly than when we first started to address it.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, so you hit on a lot of different things there, which we'll explore further. But let me start off with this one. The patient who comes in and says, you know, I've been looking at my sleep and I'm not getting 8 hours of sleep every night. I must be broken. What do you say to that patient?
Yeah. Well, and that's why, I mean, as part of an assessment, I'll give people things like the Epworth Sleepiness Scale. I'll look at what is the quality of, you know, not only what is the quality of your sleep, but how are you functioning during the day? Because that tells us a lot. Some people are going to need less sleep. Some people are going to need more. 8 hours is just sort of a ballpark. And that can change a little bit over time. I mean, we tend to exaggerate the degree to which the amount of sleep we need changes over time, you know, as we age. But yeah, you know, so some people, it's like, well, when we look at how you're functioning during the day, you know, you're actually functioning at your best, you know, with this amount of sleep. And another thing to think about is just if you're on vacation, you know, and you're just falling asleep when you feel like it and you're waking up without an alarm, you know, what does that look like for you? And you're feeling great during the day. You know, that gives us some clues about what is really, if you're not waking up to the blare of an alarm and, you know, trying to struggle to get your kids to bed or whatever. I mean, what does it look like for you where you feel like, yeah, this is optimal? And for many people, they're surprised to be like, yeah, it isn't 8 hours actually.
Yeah. And that's, I think, one of the beauties of somebody actually paying attention to their sleep and becoming educated about their sleep. Because like you just said, they may find out that, you know what, I'm a 7 hour sleeper. I don't need 8 hours. I need 7 hours. Or conversely, I'm a 9 hour sleeper. 8 is not enough for me. I need to have that 9. And that's one of the beauties of CBTI, is being able to identify what is the appropriate amount of sleep that a particular person needs, where they're going to be functioning their best and they're going to wake up and they're going to be well rested and they're going to, you know, function well throughout the day. So, you know, there's so many different benefits that come from it. So when you do this initial assessment and you're working with patients, and you alluded to it already, I think, which is, how often do you find that there might be something else also going on if, in fact, they have primary insomnia?
The majority of the time. And I mean, some of that may be an artifact of just, if somebody's coming to see a psychologist, then they're probably self-selecting to a certain degree. I mean, I do get some referrals from physicians and, you know, that sort of thing. But most people that come my way are self-referred. And but even so, the research tells us that the majority of people who have sleep difficulties, there is something else going on. And it makes a lot of sense. You know, if you, for example, struggle with anxiety, you know, then you're going to have kind of a resting level of tension that is higher than some other people's resting level of tension. And so, you know, you're naturally going to have more difficulty. Or as I mentioned, I work a lot with ADHD. And of course, folks with ADHD oftentimes have sensory processing sensitivity, which is, it's not a diagnosis, but it's just a characteristic where sometimes called highly sensitive people, you know, where they're very sensitive to sensory input. They're sensitive to interpersonal input. So, you know, so, I mean, traveling is just like a nightmare for folks oftentimes, if that's the case, you know, where just being in a hotel room, it feels different, even though hotels work very, very hard to try to get you a good night's sleep. It's like, yeah, but the sounds are different and there's just a little bit of light coming in through the blinds of this room and the blankets are tucked in too tight. It's all these things, you know, where it's like, you know, it's affecting me. And so yeah, you know, so ADHD, anxiety, lots of different things, and medical conditions. Not everybody, by the way, is appropriate for CBTI. Most people are. But, you know, if you have, and sometimes it's like, let's get this medical condition addressed first, and then see where we're at. So, you know, if somebody has sleep apnea, for example, you know, it would not be appropriate to say, I'm going to address this through CBTI. It's like, well, let's look at the sleep apnea and see where we get with that. But also, yeah, I mean, if you have a seizure disorder or you have bipolar disorder, then CBTI may not be the best choice because it may kind of make matters worse in your particular case. I mean, CBTI is very well tolerated for most people, but there are certain folks, you know, like any treatment where we say, well, you know, we want to look at some other things. So it's important to know what are the coexisting conditions. Right. To know what needs to be addressed first, what can be addressed simultaneously, and what is really like, let's do something different.
Yeah. Yeah. No, very, very good point. So, you know, one of the things you mentioned in there is ADHD, and I know that you do a lot of work with those types of patients in your practice. So let's do this. Let's take our first commercial break. When we come back, we'll talk about ADHD and sleep. So
terrific.
Stay tuned on Sleep Science Today. We'll be right back with Dr. Elise Murray.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today. And sleep better tonight.
All right, welcome back to Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We're talking about CBTI, and we were talking about co-occurring disorders. You know, one of the things I wanted to mention there is you spoke about people who have anxiety. And it's really interesting to me with a lot of my patients, what I see, and I'm sure this is what you were saying you see too, I'm guessing. You have the person who's having trouble sleeping, and so they're oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes they may be having trouble sleeping because there's some anxiety going on. Maybe they're concerned about something that's going on in their life. Maybe there's an event. Maybe they're going through a divorce, losing a job. It could be anything. There's others who can't identify any particular thing, but they know that they're just, their mind is buzzing and their body is going. And then not only do they have that impact in their sleep, then they end up with this anticipatory anxiety, which is, oh my gosh, last night I didn't sleep well. Now here we are the next night. I'm so concerned that I'm not going to sleep well. And then they have the first set of anxiety before they get to the second set of anxiety. And the good news is, at least in my experience with CBTI, once they start to get their sleep under control, then all that starts to get under control too. However, there are those cases where people may have ADHD and, you know, they've got a lot of stuff going on. What do you do with those patients?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and before mentioning that, I just wanted to, I mean, what you described really made me think about when I'm talking with folks early on in the process, I talk with them about, you know, you can think of it as three P's, you know, that there are predisposing factors. So you could have a genetic predisposition to something like anxiety, ADHD, what have you. And then you have precipitating factors. So now we've got a life event, for instance, that's happening. You know, I'm going through a divorce or whatever. I've got a lot on my mind. And then we have perpetuating factors. So we have things that are just making the sleep difficulty continue. So for all of us, we have occasional bad nights of sleep. And sometimes you know exactly why. It's like, yeah, I shouldn't have had that coffee after the movie or whatever. Right. Other times, you know, it's like, I don't know why. I just could not sleep last night. I mean, it's very common, right? You know, we have a poor night's sleep or a couple. You know, but then for some of us, there are perpetuating factors where there are just things that make it continue. So things like beliefs, you know, catastrophic thinking about, I've got to get this under control. You know, I cannot function as a manager, you know, if I'm not sleeping well or whatever it is. And so, but So we talk about all three, but the ADHD piece. Yeah. I mean, that it's so common, almost universal, that if you have ADHD, you're probably having difficulty sleeping because, as Ned Halliwell says, it's like you have a Ferrari brain with bicycle brakes. So, you know, your mind is just, you know, wonderfully like fast and imaginative. And the problem is when it comes time to sleep, of course, we don't want that Ferrari brain. We want to be able to, you know, park it in the garage. We want to be able to relax. And with ADHD, it's like the problem is that the sensory input, you know, has decreased. It's a nice dark room, you know, and we don't have the distractions of the day happening. And so that busy brain doesn't have anything to attach to. And so it's just kind of going and going and going. And so it can become a big, big challenge. And so the way that we look at ADHD, I mean, obviously, this is an example of, let's look at how your ADHD is being treated, of course, just to make sure that, you know, we're not doing anything like, you know, taking medication inappropriately or whatever, you know, that could be contributing to the problem. But a lot of, like, when I'm working with folks with ADHD, it's not dramatically different, the approach to CBTI. It's pretty similar, but it's just that we especially want to pay attention to things like, if you think about if you have a baby and, you know, typically if you've got a baby, you are very careful with their sleep routine. You're doing these things to help the baby to wind down because you really, really want them to be able to sleep through the night. So you're doing things in a predictable order and you're making sure that they're not getting stimulated. You're not, like, if it's a toddler, you're not getting them into wild play right before bed or whatever, you know, but we think that as adults, we don't need any of that. We could just, you know, our head hits the pillow and bang, which is, of course, is not the case. Right. And especially with ADHD, it's so important to just, and some of the folks I work with, they bristle at the idea of routine. I say, honestly, this is what's giving you freedom. You know, if we can, you know, establish a nice relaxing routine, that it just gives you the freedom to not have to worry so much about this stuff because, you know, you're taking care of that busy brain and helping it to transition. So
let's put all this sort of in perspective for the listener. You know, we talked about CBTI and you started to describe a little bit of what's involved before. And then we're talking about how these co-occurring, you know, issues can play a factor in here. So let's kind of go to the part of CBTI itself. If you did an assessment with a patient, you come up with, they've got primary insomnia, and let's take someone at first who doesn't have any co-occurring issues. They just got insomnia, and you determine that CBTI is going to be the right course of action for them. What can they expect? What does that mean to them? What are they going to have to do?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you know, again, of course, we're going to do the assessment first. We're going to get into educating you about your sleep, just what healthy sleep looks like. Going to look at, I give folks a questionnaire to find out what might be some of the sleep beliefs that are contributing to the problem. Okay. But after collecting the baseline data, then we're going to use that baseline data of how you've been sleeping, you know, collecting data for a week or two. We're going to use that data to determine your sleep window. And so a sleep window, what that looks like is, let's say that you, you know, you feel like your ideal sleep time when you're on vacation and everything, the amount of time that you really feel at your best with, let's say that it is 8 hours. And let's say that, you know, when we look at your total time asleep compared to your total time in bed. Okay. And we want that ratio, you know, ideally to be 85% or greater. And so in the 90s is fantastic. Uh-huh. We don't expect 100 because obviously we need time to be able to transition and, you know, get sleepy. But if you have primary insomnia, then, you know, you might be getting much, much less than that. You might be getting in the 50s or the 60s or whatever. So so what we're going to do is if we look and we see that, okay, you're spending on average, you know, you want to get 8 hours of sleep. On average, you're spending 9 hours in bed.
Okay.
But you're getting 6 hours of sleep.
Okay.
So then what we would want to do is with sleep restriction, we're going to set a sleep window where, okay, instead of having this fragmented sleep resulting in 6 hours of sleep, we're going to try to consolidate it. So if you want to get up, I always ask folks, when do you want to get up? 6 a.m. Okay. So we're going to count back and do 6 hours plus a half hour to allow you to fall asleep. So your bedtime is 11:30. And people oftentimes will be like, whoa, 11:30. You know, they get anxious at that. But it's like, it's not going to be forever. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to increase what's called sleep pressure. That because your body naturally wants you to get your rest. And so if you're going to bed later, it is going to, you know, sleep more effectively. That's what we mean by sleep efficiency. That's that number, that 85-90%, you know, that's what we're after. We want efficient sleep. So that's your sleep window is, you know, in this case, 11:30 to 6 a.m. And then after a week, we look at how things are going. And based upon how things are going, we're either going to open the window further, like if it's like, wow, that's great. Your sleep efficiency's gone way up. You know, less tossing and turning and everything, falling asleep faster. We're going to gradually pull your bedtime back, keeping the 6 a.m. wake up, you know, including weekends, which, you know, some folks bristle at that, but it's like we're trying to get you consistent here. We don't want to be like waking up at noon on the weekends, then waking up at 6 on weekdays. Anyway, if it's not quite there, then we're going to keep it there. Or, you know, if it seems like for some reason, you know, we have, you know, like your sleep is worse, like maybe as we move through the program, you know, you have a little bit of a setback. Okay, we're going to tighten up the sleep window a little bit. In my experience, moving the other direction, you know, like, oops, now we have to push it back later again. It almost never happens. I mean, your body's quite effective at recognizing, ooh, you know, I really need to get that sleep in. Uh-huh. So typically, we're either opening the window further, going to bed earlier, or we're staying the same for a bit longer. So yeah. And then eventually you end up, you know, having your 9:30 bedtime, sleeping about 10 p.m. to 6 in this example. So you're getting your 8 hours. We've opened up the sleep window to your goal.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And that typically takes, yeah, like 6 to 8 weeks.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, in summary, so many people, at least in my experience, who come in with insomnia, they, like you said, maybe they're in bed for 9 hours, but they're actually sleeping for 6 hours. And so you've got this fragmented sleep because I'm sleeping, I'm waking up, I'm sleeping, I'm having a hard time falling asleep, those types of things. And oftentimes, you know, we find that they're doing something else in bed. They're watching TV. They're scrolling on their phone, making themselves anxious over the news that they're reading or whatever it may be that they're looking at. And so by cutting out all of those things that they're doing in bed other than sleeping, we're able to then help them to consolidate so that they are, you know, and we talk about this concept of sleep restriction.
where we're saying, okay, you're actually sleeping like 6 hours of these 9 hours that you're in bed. So we're going to restrict it down to 6 hours. The way I like to describe it to my clients is, I don't really call it sleep restriction because we're not restricting your sleep. We're giving you the amount of sleep that you're actually getting. We're just cutting out all of the stuff around the edges in a way.
Yeah. It's really like bed restriction. You know, we're restricting bed to sleeping and sex. We're not doing like when I was a grad student studying in bed, you know, where I would study, that I'd set the alarm for 90 minutes, wake up 90 minutes, sleep some more, or study some more, go to bed for another 90 minutes. It was absurd, you know, but yeah, because we really want your mind is excellent at connecting the stimulus, which is bed, you know, at connecting that to sleep and sex is fine. But if you let it, you know, but on the other hand, if you are working on your taxes, you know, if you're doing all this other stuff, then, you know, well, then your mind is going to be like, yeah, yeah. And that doesn't mean, I mean, people usually get worried and they say, so I can't do anything. I can't read. I can't. And yeah, I mean, the research tells us that even if you're reading on like a Kindle or something, you have the nighttime settings. I mean, strictly speaking, that might affect your sleep duration by a few minutes. But if you're, you know, careful to do the settings and, you know, you're reading something that's kind of pleasant slash boring, not like a page turner murder mystery or whatever, you know, then it's probably fine. So if folks are still having difficulty, I'll say, let's do a little experiment. Let's have you read in a chair in your bedroom, you know, so that it's not too difficult. Right. Then when you're getting tired, then you know, it's your bedtime is approaching, then go to bed.
Right.
And sometimes that's like, okay, that helped. But yeah, no, for most people, they can read in bed.
Yeah. Well, let's do this. We've got to take our second break. So let me make sure I get that in. And when we come back, let's spend a little bit of time talking about how yoga and similar techniques might help somebody with their sleep. So stay tuned to Sleep Science Today. We'll be right back and we'll talk about yoga and sleep.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today.
All right. Welcome back to Sleep Science Today. So we're talking about CBTI, but we're also talking about people who have ADHD or people who may have anxiety and things that are keeping them up. And, you know, if someone is having trouble sleeping because they've got anxiety or they have some other issue, if we don't address that issue or give them some techniques to be able to work with that, then it's going to continue to bother them and impact their sleep. So tell us about things that you work with your clients on from a yoga perspective or any other exercises, breathing exercises, muscle relaxation. What helps?
Yeah. Well, one thing that we've just touched on and not really talked about, sleep hygiene is really, really important. And when I talk with folks about what sleep hygiene is, which is basically creating an environment that's conducive to sleep, folks will say, oh, yeah, I know about that. But when we really look at it closely, oftentimes they're doing several things, but they're not doing all of them. So they may know that, okay, yeah, I do need to have a nice dark bedroom. You know, I need to have a comfortable mattress. But they don't realize things like I have an alarm clock that shines the time on the ceiling. And I wake up and I look at that time, then I start doing mental math about this sort of thing. It's like, okay, let's talk about maybe, you know, covering that up with duct tape or changing the settings or, you know, different clocks, something. You know, like there are certain things that sometimes can make a huge difference. I talked with one woman who was shocked at just cleaning her room, you know, because she just, you know, she was just sort of in the habit of throwing her clothes on the floor. And as a result, she didn't really clean her room. And so, of course, you know, that contributed to like dust and, you know, difficulty breathing. And then also just the mental distraction of just, you know, having to kind of weave her way through all the clutter to get to bed and push stuff to the foot of the bed to sleep. You know, when she neatened it up, she was like, oh, my gosh, that already is making a huge difference, you know. Mm-hmm. So sleep hygiene is important. But then also with yoga, I became a registered yoga teacher years ago because when I first started to see clients in my private practice, I just felt like, you know, it's got to be more than talk therapy. You know, we are whole beings. We're not just minds, you know, and so when we're struggling with various things, depression, anxiety, insomnia, then the whole body is affected. So I need to understand the whole body and how that plays a role. And so I ended up getting certified as a yoga teacher because I had, you know, done yoga off and on since I was 14. And I recognized this is, you know, powerful stress relief. And my particular certification focused on mental health with yoga. And so just some examples of how yoga can help. When we're experiencing stress and tension, and we all experience stress, you know, there's positive stress and negative stress. But when we're experiencing a lot of negative stress and feeling like we're rushing through our day, we're trying to get things done and we're not able to accomplish what we want to, then we can oftentimes unconsciously, our muscles tense because our nervous system is constantly monitoring for signs of threat. You know, is everything okay? And if we're experiencing stress, then it's like our body's preparing for fight or flight. So we've got those muscles ready to go to, you know, fight the imagined adversary or to flee from, you know, the tiger, you know, going back to caveman days or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got tension in our hip flexors because we're getting ready to run. We've got, you know, tension in our shoulders because we're getting ready to fight, you know. And so oftentimes doing yoga can really be helpful. And also, this could be a whole podcast in itself, but the philosophy of yoga of just that attitude of curiosity about your own experience without all these shoulds, that things should be this way. It's really cultivates, if you have a good teacher, it's this attitude of being curious about your experience and using the breath. So, and I do want to say a word of caution that not all yoga is good for sleep. So, and not all breath work is good for sleep. There are certain breathing practices that are designed to be re-energizing, you know, so like when I've worked with folks who have the kind of depression where they're sleeping too much, you know, we might do more of an activating breathing practice. That's not what you want, you know, when you have insomnia. And certain kinds of yoga too, like for many people, Bikram or power yoga or Ashtanga, you know, where your heart rate is going up, you know, your blood pressure is going up adaptively. I mean, these are not the kinds of things you want. I've had a few people who've done Bikram is also like hot yoga. I've had a few people who've done hot yoga and found it to be helpful. But for a lot of folks, they're in that hot room and the nervous system say, uh-oh, something's wrong. And so it just raises their residual tension. And so they're like, yeah, yoga didn't help me with my insomnia. It's like, well, no, we don't want that kind of yoga. We want something more soothing. You know, looking for practices that are slower and gentler and, you know, gentle releasing, low breath, emphasis on the exhalation. But yeah, yoga can be very powerful. Raise your oxytocin levels, raise your GABA levels, you know, which are, you know, neurotransmitter hormones that help you to be able to feel at ease, to feel happier, more content.
So I can understand, obviously, the clear connection between that and anxiety. What about if the person has ADHD? Will that help them as well?
You mean yoga specifically?
Yeah, the things that you were just describing.
Yeah, it absolutely can. And I have worked with folks with ADHD where they say their mind is too busy, you know. And they, like when I mention like yoga, mentioning mindfulness, then like, oh yeah, that doesn't work for me. And when I ask them more about it, then oftentimes it's like, yeah, I tried that. I tried just like sitting and focusing on my breath and, you know, and I couldn't do it. It's like, well, you know, in the first place, our minds are meant to wander. So if you are trying to, you know, focus on the breath and, you know, your mind is wandering to all sorts of things like, did I defrost the chicken for dinner, you know, and I got to pick my kid up. Am I going to have enough time to take them to soccer practice? I mean, you know, then that's great. That's great if you're noticing that, you know, you're noticing it, then you're gently guiding it back to the breath. But with folks with ADHD, oftentimes it's just really, really difficult to sit still. It's really difficult to, even if they know, okay, it's okay for my mind to wander and I bring it back to the breath, it's just really, really hard. Then yoga can often work beautifully because the original intent of yoga was to do these physical movements to prepare your mind to be able to be still. And so it's like mindfulness in motion, which is just a better fit for a lot of folks with ADHD, than just sitting and focusing on their breath where they feel like they're going to jump out of their skin. You know, yoga works much better for them.
Right. Wow. Okay. Well, this has been very interesting. And, you know, unfortunately we have reached our time for the show. It kind of flies by here. But this has been Dr. Elise Murray. I really appreciate you sharing these perspectives with us and the additional perspectives on ADHD and yoga and the different things that can help people. So last thing I'll just ask real quick, what would you say to someone, like how would someone recognize that they might benefit from seeing someone like yourself for CBTI? What would be the signs that they should look for?
I think if you feel like your sleep is not really giving you the rest that you need to be able to function well, if you feel like if I'm sitting at a stoplight, I feel like, you know, my head is nodding forward, or, you know, just I feel like I'm short tempered. I'm, you know, those signs that you're not getting enough rest and, you know, and you're feeling like I want something that's going to be effective and, you know, maybe you're not wanting to just kind of do medication and call it good, then I would say absolutely, you know, give CBTI a try because it's just one of those treatments that works really, really well for the majority of folks.
Fantastic. Thank you. So this has been Sleep Science Today with Dr. Alice Murray. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. Join us on sleepsciencetoday.com, where you can find access to this and all of our other episodes, anything and everything you want to know about sleep, from baby sleep to mattresses to sleep trackers to CBTI. We've got it all here for you. No need to look anywhere else. We'll see you on our next episode of Sleep Science Today.
You have been listening to Sleep Science Today, your number one sleep authority.
Sleep Science Today.